Cargill, ready for our rotcast?
What are you doing?
Just preparing to record.
Oh, stop it. Stop it right now.
What's the matter? Do you find these jokes pun bearable?
Stop it or I'm going to fucking murder you.
Then I would be one of the pun dead.
I quit. This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Abandon all tofu, ye who enter here. This is Junk Food Cinema, the syrupy, schlocky, so good it's scary, cult and exploitation film cast here on Film School Rejects. I'm your host, Brian, dead and Salis buried, and I am joined by the sincomparable, the irrasible C. Robert Scargill.
Really? You couldn't be the Salisbury snake?
Well, there's one more episode to go. I mean, I'm sure I'll come up with another one after that. But if you guys want to hear the previous terrible Halloween puns that I've rolled out, just go to iTunes or to Stitcher, where you'll find the whole back catalog of Junk Food Cinema. Hey, and we're also available on Twitter if you want to follow us, at Junk Food Cinema, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And then every movie we talk about every week, or movies, if it's plural, if it's a series, we'll have Amazon links on the post, and if you click on that, it takes you to Amazon. Even if you don't buy that item in particular, getting to Amazon via that link benefits the site no matter what you buy. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you!
Well, it's Schlocktober here at the Junkyard, and we are celebrating the underrated horror of the 1990s, and tonight we arm ourselves with holy water and prepare for the clash at Demon Night. Oh my god, I'm so excited for this.
You really, really are.
I love this fucking movie. It's much.
It's a really good movie. And it's a movie that really gets shit on. And
yeah.
Sadly so. And it's one of the things, as I teased in the last episode, that really helped me get a job that I just recently was announced, signed on to. I was recently announced with, you know, my co-writer and director, Scott Derrickson, to be on the Outer Limits movie. And they brought us in and they asked us, you know, they had no idea exactly what they were looking for. They just knew, hey, we loved Sinister. We like these guys. We love Scott's other films. We would like these guys to possibly take a stab at how do you do the Outer Limits. And they were wondering if maybe we might write something original, that we would then call an Outer Limits movie that was, you know, Outer Limits Presents, blah, 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 you know, and that was the name of our movie. And that was one of those things where I just sat down and I rolled it through my head and said, we can't do that. And Scott was like, why not? And I said, there are these two really cool horror films from the 90s that are really inventive. They're really cool. And they're among some of the coolest horror films of that era, but they never make any of the top 10 lists of that era because everyone considers them glorified television episodes because they feel like they're films that couldn't stand on their own without the title in front of it. And mm-hmm. Of course, the title at this particular point was
Tales from the Crypt.
And mm-hmm. Demon Knight is the best of the two. Bordello of Blood is also good. But Demon Knight, I hold, is one of the best horror films of the 90s. It's really cool. It's really great. It does a lot of good stuff. It has fun with itself, but it's bookended by these really strange, goofy segments that are not unlike what we were just subjected to with Brian at the beginning of the episode, in which, you know, and they're funny and they're cute. You know, Demon Knight in particular opens up with, you know, the Crypt Keeper directing a film, and it's John Larroquette playing, you know, a guy.
A reincarnated murdered husband who is after his wife.
Yeah, and it's fun, but they have nothing to do with the movie, and they really detract from how good this movie is, because if you cut those scenes off and just play that movie, that movie's fucking cool.
See, and here's the thing. There is a long, crazy story about how this movie got to be a movie that explains both why those end caps are there and why they shouldn't be there. And I will say this, and I want you to understand the gravity of what I'm about to say based on who is making this statement. I can't stand the fucking Crypt Keeper. There are some great episodes of Tales from the Crypt. There's a lot of inventive screenwriting going on with that. But the fucking puns that guy makes are so awful.
They're awful, like yours.
But no, no, like they're Chris worse Cox's. Than mine. They're way worse than mine.
Care for a little Shriek preview?
No.
They totally are way worse than mine.
Lights! Camera! Action!
They really are. And that's why I could never... That's why I love this movie so much in spite of, or despite these end caps. But the movie itself is about, so it starts with a car chase in the middle of the desert where William Sadler, who is one of the great, great mainstays of the 90s, absolutely tremendous actor.
William Sadler from Die Hard 2.
Is being pursued by Billy fucking Zane in a cowboy hat.
That's Billy Zane from Dead Calm.
In Billy Zane's greatest performance.
Absolute greatest performance, and we'll get more into that in a moment. So he's being chased by Billy Zane. There's a wreck. Billy Zane, his car is flipped and exploded, and it's clear that, obviously, if he were human, he'd be dead, but he comes walking out unscathed, so automatically you know something's going on. And it turns out that William Sadler is in possession of an artifact key that Billy Zane, whose character is called the Collector, is really trying to get a hold of, and it seems to have a lot of religious weight to it. So William Sadler holds up in this it used to be a church. It is now converted into a halfway house with a
hotel.
It's basically a halfway house. So he's in there with a lot of colorful characters, and here comes Billy Zane with an army of fucking demons from hell trying to get this key back, and it becomes a siege movie. It becomes very much like an unholy assault on Precinct 13. Or assault on Precinct 666, I guess.
That is exactly what it is. And it's, you know, it's these demons that are trying to get in while these people who have issues with one another and who are not all good people are fighting to survive. And, you know, you've mentioned William Sadler, you've mentioned Billy Zane, but this movie, what really sells this movie and what really makes it is there's such a talented cast.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there are three other big names, one of whom is a really big name around here at the Junk Food Cinema Studios. And the other two are just big names.
Yeah.
You know, Jada Pinkett Smith, of course, plays, you know, this young woman who is, just gotten out of prison. You've got Thomas Hayden Church, who is playing the douchebag kind of mullet wearing, almost surfer boy kind of alpha male wannabe.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got Dick fucking Miller.
The Dick Miller. Character actor extraordinaire. The man who forever proves there is no such thing as a small part. And the man whose voice you heard heralding this episode and every episode we've pretty much ever done.
Who we were very, very fortunate to be able to interview while he was in town here about 6 months ago.
Absolutely.
And so here you have this collection of really great talent. Dick Miller being one of those, you get that guy, Dick Miller.
You get him to
play this role, and he will bring it every time. And then there's just this young group of actors who are all up and coming. Billy Zane hadn't done Titanic yet. Jada Pinkett hadn't done her successful films that, you know, got her into the sub A-list where she ended up meeting Will Smith, falling in love, and they became an epic producing team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Thomas Hayden Church was a TV guy doing Wings and hadn't yet done Sideways, which would propel him into being one of those indie Oscar caliber kind of actors. And so here's all this really strong talent, really bringing it in what is otherwise a very B movie.
Yeah, and on top of that, you have a character actress that you've probably seen in a million things, who's still in things all the time, CCH Pounder.
Oh, yes.
CCH Pounder, who will forever be, I remember her from The Shield. And then as soon as I started watching The Shield, I started noticing her in pretty much everything else I ever watched.
And she's super hot in this movie.
CCH Pounder?
Yeah.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Fair enough, man. All right.
I just loved looking at the look on your face, like just the that moment where you thought I was talking about someone else.
Yeah, I was like, okay, fair enough.
No, the thing is nobody half-asses this movie.
No, no,
like,
not at all.
No one, like even the weirdest parts, like Billy Zane is the devil. Nobody half-asses this. They all bring it, and it becomes, and that's what you really need in a siege movie.
Yeah,
in a siege movie, you have. These characters that really need to play off each other. They're essentially in a play. You've got a what is often called a fishbowl story. a fishbowl story where these characters are stuck in a room together and they can't get out and they're stuck dealing with each other's shit. And so we have a bunch of really interesting characters with a bunch of really interesting shit.
And Billy Zane still manages to steal the fucking show.
Holy shit.
Come on out, everybody. It's time to play.
If every actor enjoyed every role half as much as Zane enjoys this one, movies would never be boring. He absolutely he digs into it with all 10 fingers, all 10 toes, and every tooth in his head. He is evil and menacing one minute, he's charming the next, and then he's impersonating Hunter S. Thompson in the next moment. Like, he goes all over the map, and yet somehow every moment feels true to that character.
Well, and he's called the Collector, but for years, people have just straight up referred to him as the devil.
Yeah.
That he's the devil and that he's there. Whether or not he is really arguable. You know,
I don't think it matters, frankly.
Well, we got into this argument at Fantastic Fest this year because there was at a little event that you partook in.
Yep.
There was, you know, Family Feud, Fantastic Feud. There was a moment where a bunch of people were polled on who is the best incarnation, who is the best, you know,
on-screen devil.
Mm-hmm. And most people said the Darkness from Legend,
which is so not correct. That doesn't even take place.
Well, that was the point where I stood up in the audience and said, the Darkness is not the fucking devil. And Scott Weinberg is like, wait, is that Cargill? It's like, yes, it is. And he's not the devil. And people are like, yeah, he's not the devil. He's like, talk to the people who I asked the question to.
Because I said that same thing. And then I heard this voice from the back of the room. He's not the devil. And I was like, I know who that is. Because I absolutely agree with that. It is not the fucking devil.
I would argue that Billy Zane is the devil.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether the final moments of the movie can kind of call that into question, but don't exactly contradict that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the argument, to me, he's more like, he's the devil in the same way that, like, Jonathan Pryce in Something Wicked This Way Comes is the devil. He's sort of an instrument of temptation. He's a guy that's able to pinpoint your one darkest, because he does this all throughout the movie with all the various characters, because he can't, the blood within the key prevents the demons from being able to just waltz into the building. So he has to try and get inside the heads of the characters and convince them to break those walls and let them in. So the way that he does that is very much like Jonathan Pryce in Something Wicked This Way Comes. He plays to the innermost desires of each character and tries to tempt them out. So, I mean, in that way, as the ultimate tempter, the father of lies kind of aspect of the devil, yeah, sure. But beyond that, I really don't think it's... I mean, as long as you recognize that he's an agent of hell...
But he's just... The way he goes so over the top in such a wonderful way makes him anything, you know, it's just one of those great performances of evil, that whether you consider him the devil or not, whether...
Yeah, that's what I mean. I don't think it...
It doesn't matter, but it really, as far as best performances of a devil character... He's up there with my favorite, you know, because my personal favorite on-screen devil was not mentioned as Needful Things with Max von Sydow.
Aha.
Who I think in my mind is one of the greatest incarnations of the devil I've ever seen. But I just love the theatrical glory that is Billy Zane in this movie. Like, he fucking owns it. That movie, that moment he's outside and he starts doing the hoedown.
Oh my God. The great line that is, and let me see if I can get this right. Fuck this cowboy shit.
You fucking hoedunk. Well then there, motherfuckers.
It's such a great line.
And the way he does the little shuffle, the hoedown shuffle when he does it, it's just, it's funny and it's cool and it's menacing all in the same moment.
Yeah.
Like, there's a comedy to it, but there's also a menace to that comedy. Like, this is a guy that's really angry and is venting that through this kind of comic frustration because he's got all the time in the world.
And there's something weirdly relatable about the way he plays the character. Like, at one point, the exchange he has with William Sadler, that is my absolute favorite, is not like quoting, you know, passages of the Bible or dropping these really epic action one-liners. he's like, give it to me. Dude, seriously? Just give me, what? You're not going to give it to me? Really? Seriously? Like, they're talking to, like, they're a couple of high school kids having an argument.
But they're having this conversation, and he's like, come on, man. You know you can't win this. You know what happens at the end of this night. Why does it even fucking matter?
Yeah.
And it's the kind of conversations that don't really make sense until you get to the end of the movie, and then you rewatch it and realize just everything that's going on. Because this movie is one of those movies that every 10 minutes or so, your thoughts on what's happening changes.
Mm-hmm.
The first time you watch it, you're like, oh, I know what this is. And then you're like, oh, wait, no, I know what this is. And you're like, oh, no, I had it wrong. I know it. And you don't really know what it is until the third act.
Right.
And when it's all finally explained, it's such a wonderful, wonderful explanation. And one of my favorite things about the end of this film is how it plays into one of the seduction moments during the film.
Right.
That what the devil's offering is what that character ends up getting anyway.
Right, exactly. And,
but not in the way they ever imagined, which is just such a cool horror temptation moment. Like, that character ends up getting that ending that was promised, but not the way that it was promised.
Yeah.
And it's really, really cool how that happens.
Yeah, and it's, you know, there is a lot of, so I guess you could call it like gallows humor throughout the whole movie, but at the same time, it goes to some really dark places. Like, on the one hand, you have a scene where CCH Pounder has her arm ripped off, and then Billy Zane shows up to, as a temptation, oh, I can give you your arm back, and she raises her bloody stub, and he says, is that a yes? And she goes, no, that's me flipping you off. You just can't see it.
Yeah, and that moment, she's so fucking cool in that moment.
And then at the same time, later on in the movie, they kill a kid. Like, a little kid dies. Like, it is like, you know, every moment you think, oh, this is just a really silly, you know, goofy comedy, they'll turn around and do something, like, really dark. And then the explanation of where the blood came from and how William Sadler came into possession is, like, really kind of heavy and dense. And it's like, wow, this movie is playing with a lot of different tones.
Well, yeah, no. In fact, there's a great moment towards the end of the movie where we find out this character who we think is just this really nice, nebbish guy. Is actually a fucking psychopath who's about to go and shoot up his mail room.
Yeah,
you know?
See, that's the thing is all the movies we've been talking about, you know, in this series, while they all, in our opinion, stay in the test of time, there are elements of them that make them absolutely inescapably 90s. And for me, in this movie, apart from its cast, which feels like a 90s waiting room the way Predator 2 does, it is the reference to the angry, psychotic postal worker, which was an actual problem in the 90s. You had all these postal workers going insane and literally going postal. Like, that's where that expression comes from.
And he's written this letter to one of the other characters who at this point is dead in the movie, professing his love and how he's doing this all for her.
Yeah.
And it's just like...
So it's funny,
dude,
but also like
fucked up.
Really fucked up at the same time.
And that's that is one of the things about this movie is that, you know, that's how a fishbowl movie really, or a fishbowl story of any kind works best, is that when you have characters with these layers that you think are one thing and then you find out in one way or another something else. Characters that you think are gonna, you know, you think, I forget her name, but the girl is the hooker with the heart of gold.
Oh, yeah.
And she ain't a hooker with the heart of gold. She's just a hooker.
Yeah.
And she's not. And of course, the character that you think is the, you know, the smart ass pain in the ass who's gonna die early is actually not at all the character that she hints at being.
And not only that, but like we were talking about with Event Horizon and bucking traditions.
Event Horizon!
No, we can't do that every day, but we're going to. But about bucking tropes and traditions in horror, who ends up being the hero of the movie? Who ends up being the survivor is the black woman. Like, they took the two, like, they took the two worst things you could be in a horror film, mashed them together, and made her the strong survivor at the end.
Yeah.
And the ultimate hero of the whole fucking movie.
And that's what...
Even though we have a hero at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
We don't even know we're looking for another. We don't need another
hero.
But
the hero at the beginning of the movie is William Sadler.
Yeah.
You know, who is not a guy you cast as a hero in this era. You know, I mean, at this point, you know, before he made this, he was the guy with, you know, kind of the stutter who wasn't so bright in Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
which is where most of you know him from. William Sadler's such a great character.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is the actors in this movie that aren't big name stars are great character actors. Like, there aren't any real weak links in this cast at all.
No, there's not a weak link to be found. And
the only person you really don't know is the girl who plays the hooker.
Yeah.
Brenda
Bakke, I believe is how you say her last name.
But she's great. She's fantastic in this. And she, you really feel for her. And then when you have her turn, it's just like, oh, Jesus, dude.
I always kind of considered her like a Diet Coke version of Tay Leone in this movie. Just like Diet Coke Tay Leone. That's how I categorize her in my head, so I remember who she is. But, you know, I got to say this. You know what? Another place people probably know William Sadler from more recently is Iron Man 3. He plays the president in Iron Man 3.
Well, yeah, yeah.
That's probably another place.
You've seen William Sadler in a billion things because he always brings it. He's one of those character actors. When you hire William Sadler, you get William Sadler.
You're never saddled with Sadler. You're always happy to have him.
Crypt Keeper.
Nope, that was better. I maintain it was better. Sorry, scoreboard. So the other thing we need to talk about in this movie is, you know, we've been talking about the things that kind of made it definitively 90s, but then, of course, it has amazing practical effects. The design of the demons themselves, just, like, it's not what I expected at all the first time I watched it. I have a funny story, actually, about this movie. Years and years ago, when I was a little kid, I was in Mount Vernon, Illinois, for a family reunion with my mother's family.
Because that's the only reason you end up in Mount Vernon.
Yeah, pretty much. And then some family had come down from Michigan. There were people in from everywhere.
Sorry to all of you who listened from Mount Vernon.
Yeah, probably one of my aunts and no one else. So they were all in town, and they wanted to rent a movie, and they were all horror hounds. Now, at this point, this movie came out in 1994. 95.
I want to say 95.
95. I was like just at the point of getting into horror, but it wasn't really like demons and zombies. It wasn't really my thing yet. I was like, if I watched horror, it was like a Halloween or another slasher movie. So it wasn't really my cup of tea. I decided to kind of hang out in the back room while they sat and watched Tales from the Crypt Demon Night. So that's the movie they rented on VHS, and they all sat down to watch it in the living room. I'm hanging out playing Nintendo in the back room, and every once in a while I'll just hear these sounds. And the movie, like, from a distance, you know, when you're not looking at it and you're a little kid and you're not really like in tune with movie making or various tones or what a movie can be, it sounds like the scariest shit you could possibly imagine. And for years, that's just Billy Zane. And for years I assumed this was just a truly terrifying dark film. And then, you know, when I got older and I actually watched it, I was like, wow, this is actually a lot of fun. I like this a lot. But I had built up in my head, like, what I thought the demons looked like. And in my head, they were very shadowy. They were kind of like, almost like the ghost beings in Ghost that drag people to hell, like these kind of formless, but very unsettling things to look at. And then when I watched it, I was like, wow, they're like dancers in costumes with these, like, really large, elaborate face pieces. And they're all, you know, kind of cut from the same cloth, but they each have their own personality. It was like really bizarre and wonderful, the combination of things that came together to design these demons.
Yeah, it's a very weird kind of concept in how they do it, because that is where the Tales from the Crypt thing comes in. Whereas solid a horror movie this is and how much fun it is, they decide to go for camp at moments and cheap out when they probably shouldn't. Like the effects of when you shoot the demons in the eyes, because that's one of the big things.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah.
The effects of that are done in this very EC Comics kind of way.
Yeah.
And that's something that they went for that was very deliberate. You know, there's even a moment in the movie where they're reading, you know, an old copy of Tales from the Crypt, which is the nod to the movie.
And which is weird, because this is not based on any EC Comics Tales from the Crypt. Like, it's completely separate.
No, and it was one of those things where it almost felt like, okay, we have to put a nod in here somewhere, because otherwise the producer's going to be like, how is this a Tales from the Crypt movie? We don't understand.
Right.
Which is where my big problem with this movie comes in. You know, because this is a movie that could have stood on its own. Had this movie been released in the same year, on the same weekend as Demon Night, instead of Tales from the Crypt Demon Night, I think this movie would not only have done better, but I think it would have overall been much better remembered.
Yeah.
Because I think the campiness of what they put into the movie, only damages what is otherwise a really, really great horror entry from that era.
Yeah.
And like we talked about in previous episodes, the thing that marks, you know, this era of filmmaking right before, you know, the Scream revolution is this is one of those, you know, movies that is really trying to do something different because they were trying to figure out what horror was at this point.
Yeah.
Because horror was just a broken genre. You know, it had been run into the ground with all this goofy, campy shit. And, you know, even the most tried and true, franchises were only being marked, you know, were only working with guys who were of my generation, of my age, where, you know, I was 13 years old and going, give me another goofy, you know, Friday the 13th and another, give me another goofy Nightmare on Elm Street. And it was movies like this that eventually brought horror back into the fold until, you know, the revolution that came that, you know, some people rejected and some people in the mainstream embraced.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a movie that, while the campiness and the goofiness of that previous era is trying to be spoon-fed into this movie, the movie is trying to be something even better than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like I said, I think it's the exact mix of humor and action and darkness, and, you know, like it should be all over the place. It shouldn't work, but it does. And it works tremendously well. And of course, a lot of that is owed to the cast, and a lot of that is owed to, the creature effects. I think when you start getting into these tight spaces, especially as you know, they're, you know, moving like you do in a siege movie, you start in a larger space and you kind of whittle yourself down until you're basically locked in a single room. And as you go through the tighter corridors running from the monsters, I think is when the movie has its best moments, where, you know, you're getting even more claustrophobic, and then you're seeing more of these demons, which I think are so beautifully designed. And then there's that great moment when Thomas Hayden Church shows his true colors, which he's been a dick the whole time, so it's not like it's a surprise. But he looks down into the lobby of the building, and they're just all over the lobby. And it's like, because like I said, these are dancers, a lot of them, inside these costumes. So they're doing these like really sort of bizarre fluid movements, even as they're just standing there. And then as they kind of like converge on Thomas Hayden Church, it's like, it's a really unsettling moment, but it works really well.
You know, the thing we haven't said, that should be said, is this is a Carpenter film not made by Carpenter.
Yeah.
This is all of the elements here. It's clear Carpenter was an inspiration, that they were trying to make a Carpenter film.
Well, like I said before, it's essentially Assault on Precinct 666. I mean,
that's, yeah. But it's not just, it's more than just Assault on Precinct 13. How they deal with the characters and the character moments and the seriousness and the weight that they give to what are otherwise silly elements. You know, it's essentially when you break the movie down, it's about a guy running around with a relic that contains, you know, bits of the blood of Christ being mm-hmm. chased by the devil, who just wants to get it back because if he has it, he can collapse the universe and bring, you know, evil about an era of evil and chaos and end creation. And
so it's like the fourth movie of his apocalypse.
Yeah, trilogy. it's almost silly, except that they refuse to let it be silly. And when Billy Zane goes over the top, it still feels like it's right for the character and it's right for the movie.
Yeah.
Like, you never sit there and not buy into the movie for its silliness. You never have to excuse it, except with those few little, you know, moments and effects that we talked about previously. But none of the character moments, none of the writing, do you ever excuse this thing for being what it is. It is just good. It is just fun. It is just what a horror movie of that era was supposed to be. And it's really effective. And just having that name tacked onto it and those bookends just makes everyone forget that it was a real movie and not a glorified TV episode.
Well, I think the reason it's able to kind of maintain the balance is that even in its silliest moments, those moments are based on what we've learned about these characters so far. Like, for example, in the temptation scenes, the one that's my absolute favorite, it involves Dick Miller. It's the one where he's trying to tempt Dick Miller. And Dick Miller's just like this old, lonely guy who loves to drink.
Yeah.
So he basically shows up to a beer ad, to a 90s beer ad. He opens a door and all of a sudden there's women and...
And they're all topless. And they all recognize him and they all love him and they all want to sleep with him and they all want to pour beer down his gullet.
And standing behind the bar is Billy Zane as Hunter S. Thompson. He's got this long cigarette holder and the casino dealer hat and the big sunglasses.
Suck this one down, Uncle Willie. Long, hard one. Nothing gets you fucked up fast. Am I right, guys? Am I right?
like, it's so much fun to watch him just like disappear into like, oh, this new sub character I'm playing. But the reason that none of this feels phony and the reason it doesn't detract from the overall movie is because the silly moments come from Billy Zane's character's ability to get inside the head of the other characters and to give them exactly the reality that they want.
Well, and they start out, he starts out slow and it progressively gets bigger.
Yeah.
You know, there's that great speech where he's talking to the hooker in which he's talking about how she just wants to be loved.
Right.
And how she just wants to be respected. And she's always been looking for that guy and she fell into what she fell into and how she just really just wants someone to see her for the wonderful person she is. And it's just kind of heartbreaking and you want her to resist that and she can't.
Right.
And once you see that and it starts getting bigger and bigger, yeah, of all the people that deserve that big, you know, topless, you know, porn actress, you know,
beer commercial
fantasy, it's Dick Miller. And you see that and you're like, well, what 60 something dude doesn't want that? You know, he doesn't want to feel young again, doesn't want to drink and have sex with fucking 21-year-old girls with perfect tits.
And then
that is what this society sets us up to think that we're supposed to want.
Right.
And so of course that character is, and all he's offering him, he never talks him into anything. He's just like handing him drinks. And that's all he's been looking for the whole time that he's inside. And it's just like, well, of course this is the road this guy's going down.
And it leads to one of the great effects moments in the movie where we see the demonized Dick Miller with that like great makeup and then like it's like this green like sludge coming out of his. He's just like, he's fierce looking. And then he instantly will turn around like somebody's about to shoot him and he turns around and it's just lovable Dick Miller again. He goes like, you're not going to shoot your
Uncle Dick.
I
forget what his name is. In the movie. He's Dick Miller.
Dick Miller. So we just know him as Dick Miller.
Dick Miller role. Like, yeah. I mean, right.
His Uncle Willie. Uncle Willie.
Yeah, Uncle Willie. You walk into the shop, Uncle Willie's shop, and he's just, he walks out with alcohol, and he's like, "Hey, you shouldn't be here. You should have a drink with me." And it's like, fuck yes, Dick Miller. And of course I'll sit and have a drink with you. I'm William Sadler. So it's William Sadler and Dick Miller having a drink. It's not Uncle Willie and, you know, the savior of humanity. It's fucking
these two guys. William
Sadler. It's two amazing character actors.
Which leads to a great joke where the hooker sits up on the table trying to seduce William Sadler.
Oh.
And then the cat jumps on the table and CCH Pounder just yells, "Get that pussy off the table." So she jumps off the table and she goes, "No, I meant the cat."
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, no, this the movie has its funny moments, but the funny moments never feel so silly that you can't invest yourself in this movie.
Exactly.
And that's what makes it such a 90s movie, because it's a movie that's trying to walk the line between being a real movie and doing something cool and inventive with horror and being a John Carpenter style movie.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, trying to play to that audience that came to see a movie with Tales from the Crypt on it.
Yeah.
And I think it does a really great job of the first part. I think, you know, it doesn't play to exactly what they wanted for a Tales from the Crypt movie. I think people wanted something sillier and more over the top, but I don't know. I mean, I didn't go and see this when it first came out because it was a Tales from the Crypt movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I go and see real movies. I don't go see television episodes that I have to pay $7 for.
Right.
And it wasn't until people were like, oh God, you got to see Demon Knight. This guy, Billy Zane's amazing. It's like, all right, fine. And when it came out on video, I was like, holy shit, this movie's fucking cool as shit.
Yeah.
And it became one of those movies that I would bring up to people when people would talk about the best horror movies of the 90s. And I'd be like, you know, Demon Knight. And it would be like they'd forgotten that it existed.
Yeah.
And it was like I was dusting something off. And it's like, this movie is so much better than so much of the other schlock that people remember from the 90s. You know, more people remember Disturbing Behavior than they do Demon Knight.
That is a true fact.
And they sit next to each other in the fucking horror section.
This is a sad fact. And, you know, I wonder if this movie suffers from the same problem that Season of the Witch does, where people were quick to write it off because it was a Halloween sequel that didn't have Michael Myers, which
had it been called Season of the Witch, just call it Season of the Witch 3.
Yeah,
but I still admire what they were trying with Halloween. But the problem was that they made Halloween 2. Had Season of the Witch been Halloween 2, then people would have been, oh, it's an anthology series and it's horror films set at Halloween and Michael Myers, that's just another movie. But because
so it's even more apt comparison those two.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. No, it is. It's one of those movies that people, you know, when, because my wife had never seen Halloween 3 and I showed it to her last Halloween. What in our, because every Halloween she's like, I want to watch horror movies. My wife loves horror movies more than I do, if you can imagine such a thing. she's like, I want to watch horror movies. It's like, honey, you've seen almost everything. And the moment I found out she hadn't seen Halloween 3, I'm like, oh, we're fucking watching it on Halloween night. It's happening. And so she's like, all right, but this is the bad one, right? I'm like, no, this is the one everybody calls the bad one, which is actually a good one. And then we watched it and she was like, that was really weird, but really good. And because it's not Michael Myers, you have that issue. And that's what I honestly believe is the problem with Demon Knight.
Yeah.
And that's why, leading back to what, you know, what I talked about at the beginning of the episode, that's where, when they asked us what we wanted to do with a, you know, an Outer Limits movie, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, the only way to do this right is to take a classic episode of The Outer Limits and give it a real budget and update it, you know, update what needs updating, but stay to what's true to that story that makes that story so great, and do that episode.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, what episode is that? And we're like, Demon with a Glass Hand. And they're like, yes, that's a movie. And so we've avoided that problem of Outer Limits presents some random thing that Scott Derrickson and C. Robert Cargill wrote. And instead we're actually doing something that's Outer Limits. That's what I wish they'd done with Tales from the Crypt.
Well,
if they were going to make a Tales from the Crypt movie, they should have taken one of those episodes that everybody loved and wanted to see more of and extended that and gave it like a big budget, rather than taking a great script like Demon Knight and putting a bit at the end of the movie after you've watched these characters, you know, after you watch that bus drive away and you see the collector, and it's that cool moment where you're like, fuck, this goes on and this is a great story and this is cool. And you start thinking about all the things, and then all of a sudden the Crypt Keeper shows up at the, you know, the world premiere of Tales from the Crypt.
The world screamier.
Ugh. And you're just kind of like, oh, wait, this is still a movie. Oh, I was just reveling in the joy of that movie, and now I'm watching a puppet make puns at me.
Well, what do you know? I asked for Final Cut, and I got it!
If I wanted that, I would just go and do my podcast. I wouldn't, you know, be watching a movie.
Get your hand out of my ass. I'm not your puppet. But you know what?
I'm your puppet.
That's creepy. That's so creepy. So, but there's a reason why this wasn't an episode of the show.
Hit me.
An episode of a show blown up into a movie. This movie has one of the most bizarre stories from first inception to actually getting to the screen. It was originally planned to be the second film in a trilogy of Tales from the Crypt spinoffs, but they decided to move it up to the first film because it was the most reminiscent of the show. The next two films were supposed to be Dead Easy, which was a New Orleans zombie flick,
which they talk about at the end of the movie. They're like, stay tuned for the next movie, Dead Easy.
Yeah, and then Body Count was the third one, but neither one was made. But even before that, you have to go back even further. You have to go back to 1987, before the show was even on the air. The first draft of the script was written in 87, and had nothing to do. It wasn't based on anything from EC Comics' Tales from the Crypt. The draft was supposed to be directed by Tom Holland, who had just done Child's Play and was looking for another movie, you know, something else, another hit. And he went so far as to hire effects guys to start doing pre-production on this movie called Demon Knight. But then, get this, he bailed to direct Fatal Beauty. A fatal mistake, because that movie was an enormous fucking bomb. So then the script gets passed to Mark Carducci, who is the writer on Pumpkinhead. So he got a hold of the script.
Which is awesome.
It's a great movie.
Probably do an episode on someday.
Fuck yeah, we should. In fact, didn't that also come out in the 90s? Like early, Pumpkinhead? Like 1990, 1991?
I should look 80s, into that. Early 90s.
Because we could probably do a whole second series of underrated movies, underrated horror movies from the 90s. Anyway,
well, clearly, but
yeah. Anyway, so Mark Carducci gets a hold of it, but then he just sits on it. He just holds it for a while. And then it goes to Pet Sematary director Mary Lambert, who wanted to change. This is a really interesting concept. She wanted to change the protagonist to a black man to make a point about how the oppressed people of Earth are also its saviors, which I think would have been an interesting direction to take that in. But in the meantime, she decides to direct Pet Sematary 2, which was such a colossal failure that she then couldn't get anybody to bankroll her version of Demon Knight. So yet again, it has stalled. It has stopped. Then it gets to Full Moon, which is, of course, the Charles Band production company that brought us things like Puppet Master and Dolls.
And before it was Full Moon, Charles Band brought us the fucking Eliminators.
That's true. That's true. That is an absolute truth fact. So it's
these are facts that are true.
Facts that are true. So it's at Full Moon, but the budget needed to complete the film was too rich for Charles Band's blood. So it dies.
Because his movies are cheap as fuck.
They're made for $12. They're made for...
And that's the point to them.
Yeah, yeah. So it dies again. And then finally, it gets to Joel Silver's desk. And it gets optioned as the second of the trilogy because by now the show has been on TV and is starting to be a huge hit. Mm-hmm. So they're like, okay, not only are we going to make this movie, it is going to be the second of a trilogy. And then they were like, well, you know what? Actually, let's make it the first movie of the trilogy because it seems, which is hilarious to me because the reasoning was it seems the most reminiscent of the show. And it's like, but it's not based on anything from the show or the comics, but okay, sure. Why not?
It's reminiscent of the show.
And it had the most potential. So they take it and they slate it for Halloween 1994. And then it gets pushed to January 13th, 1995, because they like the idea of releasing it on Friday the 13th. But it's like, it's not over yet. Because even as it gets to Joel Silver, even as he green lights the movie and says, yes, we're going to do this, as they start production, there are two versions of the script, both in play. One that has demons and one that doesn't have demons. And the one that doesn't have demons was
called Knight.
No, it was called Demon Knight. No, but yeah, no, it should have just been called Knight. So they wrote a version of the script that basically was, if we can't get the money to do actual practical demons, here's a version of the script where Billy Zane's character is not the devil. Well, he is the devil, but he's masquerading as a Bible salesman, and he's got an army of dudes in suits and glasses who are also salesmen who are de facto his demons. So okay.
That's a very 90s idea.
That's a very 90s. So yeah, it's basically like a weird like Apple computer commercial coming, you know, as the antagonist. You know,
there's a bit of tongue-in-cheek satire there. Sure, that's a little bit high-minded. That's not the worst idea in the world.
But it was totally just to get around if they couldn't get the money to do actual demons. And Universal, to their credit, heard that idea and went, so our demons are basically just yuppies? Yeah, I don't like that, because the movie's called Demon Knight. That doesn't make a lot of sense. Here's more money. Put some actual fucking demons in this. So to Universal's credit, they actually upped the budget because they're like, no, Demon Knight needs to have demons in it. And that is the weird winding road that led from the initial script to this movie getting on the screen. It is absolutely fucking bug nuts.
That sounds, you know, because the movie feels like an 80s film.
It absolutely does.
And in the best ways. And to see that it took that long, you know, that it had that 8-year process, it's not out of the ordinary for oddball films. But yeah, just to end up that way. It's really sad because it's really good. I imagine that could you imagine what the Tom Holland version of that movie from 1987 might be?
I'm not the world's biggest Tom Holland fan.
No, but can you imagine for a moment? Let's pretend for a moment. Let's play your movie universe game. Let's think about what an early draft of that might be.
Yeah.
And how serious that film might feel. I mean, we wouldn't have Billy Zane because Billy Zane was too young at that point when we'd gotten that gig. You know, we wouldn't have that cast at all. You could have Dick Miller. Miller had just a few years ago done Terminator. He was still, you know, doing oddball roles like this. That is a possibility. Probably not going to happen, but it's a possibility. You know, done Terminator, done Gremlins. Every time people saw him, I'm like, oh, I love that guy. But yeah, you don't get the rest of this cast.
No.
You don't have Thomas. And you get a movie
I would imagine you get a movie that's way more melodramatic too. Way more like playing up the family dynamics and making it almost a little too much about The drama of like this fictive family being pulled apart by these demons. I don't know. It's all speculation, but
I think his producer Joel Silver got this right, because Joel Silver gets this stuff.
Yeah,
you know, Joel Silver notoriously had, you know, he had such a long tumultuous career. There's so many if you run into people from that era of Hollywood. Everyone has a Joel Silver story, and they're not all good.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're epic in how bad they are. But he was a guy who had pissed off so many people that Warner Brothers just up and canceled his contract and bought out the rest of his films that he had on this big, long 30-movie deal.
They basically paid him to not make movies.
Yes, and kind of sent him on his merry way and kicked him off the lot. And yet, the thing is he did a lot of really amazing things,
mm-hmm.
and took a lot of chances that nobody took. He was the one that took a chance on, you know, Shane Black and Shane Black's little movie starring Robert Downey Jr. and said, hey, Warner Brothers, you need $15 million to make this thing called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And they said, fine, whatever, go make your movie. And of course, you know, it rebooted two careers at once. He's the guy who fixed what was going wrong with Die Hard and churned out Die Hard and had all this, you know, all these really great movies that came out, you know, that, you know, was the guy who believed in this weird little fucking movie that nobody at Warner Brothers got called The Matrix, but fuck it. You know, he seems to, let's give him, this guy's a golden boy. Let's give it, you know, this guy. And so this is one of those movies where he just, you know, he put his weight behind it and said, let's make a goofy, campy movie that believes in itself. And it churned out Demon Knight.
For the record, Pumpkinhead was 1988. I was wrong about that. But weird little coda to the legacy of Demon Knight. As we all know, Demon Knight was followed by Bordello of Blood. And then the well kind of ran dry.
Which bombed.
It bombed big time.
I think it
made
$5 million its opening weekend.
It bombed big time, and the well seemed to have run dry on Tales from the Crypt movies. But that doesn't mean the third movie of that trilogy wasn't released. And I didn't even know about this.
Oh, wow.
There was a third movie in that trilogy released, and it was called Ritual. And it starred Jennifer Grey and Tim Curry. And the thing is, when this movie was released in theaters, now this movie didn't come out in the States on DVD until about 2006. It was released in foreign countries in theaters in 2001. When it was released in theaters, there was no mention whatsoever of Tales from the Crypt. It was not mentioned as a Tales from the Crypt movie at all, and it wasn't until it hit home video, until the DVD released, that there were any references to the Tales from the Crypt franchise. And if you look at the DVD cover, the Crypt Keeper's up in the top left corner sporting some very borderline offensive dreadlocks for some reason. The third movie, Ritual, was released. But for some reason,
did they shoot it before the release of Bordello of Blood, when Bordello of Blood, you know, tanked?
No, as far as I can tell, this was filmed in early 2000, and then released in foreign countries in 2001 in theaters with no mention of Tales
probably
from the Crypt
whatsoever.
Probably
because they probably put some money behind it, and people believed in the script and wanted to. I've never seen Ritual.
I was doing research on this movie, and I just kept digging, and I was like, "What the fuck is Ritual?" It was mentioned in such an offhand, like, "Oh yeah, and Ritual." I was like, "What do you mean Ritual? What the hell is that?" So. Yeah, that's another interesting situation there. Oh, and second coda, Ernest Dickerson, who ended up getting the job of directing Demon Knight, also directed a movie that I know you have a lot of strange affinity for, and that is Surviving the Game with Ice-T. So that's pretty amazing.
Who doesn't love Surviving the Game with Ice-T?
Everyone who's not you.
It makes you feel good, do it.
Well, that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing of the week. And this week, I gotta go with Hershey's Demon Treats. Every Halloween, the Hershey Corporation offers a mixture of their various candy products that they then dub Demon Treats. And this mixture is obviously designed to make it more convenient for handing out their candy to trick-or-treaters. It's not simply the arbitrary nickname given to this collection of candy bars that makes it an appropriate junk food pairing. Like Demon Treats, Demon Knight is a mixed bag. However, unlike some uneven films that could also be deemed mixed bags, each and every item in this strange assortment works. Sometimes Demon Knight is sinfully delectable, sometimes it's smooth, sometimes it's downright nutty. But once you start delving into it, you aren't going to find yourself able to stop until that bag is empty. Hershey's Demon Treats, this week's junk food pairing for Tales from the Crypt Demon Night. Or as we've always just referred to it, Demon Night.
Cut! Cut, 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 cut!
Well, that's going to do it for Junk Food Cinema this week. Thank you so much for listening. I want to remind you yet again, you can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. If you want to go back through the underrated horror of the 90s series we've been doing all Schlocktober long, you can check back with us on iTunes and Stitcher through that back catalog. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And please do click on those Amazon links for all your Amazon buying needs. We would appreciate it. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
On Twitter at @massaworm, MASSAWYRM, or at hot, or
at Hotmail?
You can find me on Hotmail, or at facebook.com/massaworm.
Hotboyworm at hotmail.com. Oh, yeah.
Hotboyworm.
Oh, that's disgusting.
It's 10 o'clock at night. Who are you calling? Call the party line at Hotboyworm.
I feel like we would make the worst phone sex operators imaginable, because we wouldn't say, what are you wearing? We'd say, what are you watching?
What are you watching?
What are you, what are you watching?
Hi, podcasters. What are you listening to after us? What are you wearing?
What smooth sounds are invading your ear canals as you drive the lonely roads of the internet tonight?
Oh, yeah. You know you can dig it. You want some Brian and Cargill.
I feel like I'm making love to my microphone, and I'm not okay with that.
Oh, the microphone is loving the love.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at BrianGuySalisbury, or on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic. You can also find me over at One of Us.
Uncomfortable.
You can also find me over at oneofus.net, podcasts, blogs, and whatever your fandom is. We have something for you, so please do pop over there and check it out. But yeah, that's gonna do it for us. So for Cargill, this is Brian issuing this salutation via con diablos, everybody.